everyone, and welcome back to Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartleball, and I'm joined with Chris Durham. Chris?
Hey, guys. We are going to look at the Phantasm series. We decided when the Phantom Ravager was coming out that we would sit down and go through all of the movies because...
Perhaps foolishly.
Perhaps foolishly. I think that I had seen all of them up until the fifth one, not including, of course, at the time when we decided this, and you had only seen two of them.
Yes, the first two, and by the time the second one rolled around and I watched that, I was feeling very befuddled about what the series was and what I was watching, so I was glad we could kind of watch them all and wrap it up so I kind of knew what I was getting into.
I'd like to ask you at the very end whether your befuddlement actually ceased or not.
That's an excellent question.
Whether you're less befuddled after watching five of these than you were befuddled after watching two. I had seen all of them, again, one, two, three, and four, but I was hazy on a lot of details.
As are the films themselves.
Right. We went back into it a couple weeks ago. We watched about two an evening.
Mm-hmm.
I think we broke it up, so we watched one and two, or we watched one alone, then we did two and three, and then four and five. So we had about three evenings of this, and by the end of it, my wife was just walking past or sitting down for a few minutes and saying, you know, this is kind of embarrassing, and then leave. Yeah. But the first film also was re-released this year in sort of a new remastered edition, mm-hmm. which I think you told the story that it was sort of because of J.J. Abrams.
I read an article somewhere that basically J.J. wanted to show like a group of up-and-coming filmmakers or people that worked with him this classic Phantasm movie. So he asked Don Coscarelli if he could get a copy of it, and they kind of put their heads together and said, why don't we just go ahead and remaster this and like put out a new version for the world to see? It's been years and years and years. Let's clean this up a bit and re-release it. So that's, as far as I know, that's what happened.
Yeah, I've heard too that, and JJ said this, that the character of Captain Phasma in Force Awakens is named after Phantasm.
No way!
Because of her chrome shiny helmet, he made a mention that reminded him of the silver balls.
Fantastic! And that's so, a great piece of trivia.
Yeah, that's more interesting than Captain Phasma's character.
Yes,
in the Force Awakens. At this point, if someone doesn't know what Phantasm is, we should probably explain just enough for them to know. Chris, can you summarize the basic gist of the first film?
Oh.
Not the whole film, but I guess the overarching idea here.
Where to begin? I think for me, what it boiled down to was we have a kid who's dealing with the possibility of his brother going away and kind of not dealing with that well. At the same time, like, one of their family friends dies. And so for him, this whole thing, I feel, is almost like a dream experience where he's seeing this phantom evil force trying to destroy things in his life.
This force being the Tall Man.
Yes.
Who is a character who persists through the entire series. Tall, grave-faced, no pun intended, Undertaker character who shows up and has an army, we won't talk of where they come from, but basically an army of little hooded dwarves.
Some would call them Jawas.
Yeah, they do look very much like Jawas, running behind tombstones and whatnot. And then the flying silver sphere.
Yes.
With a blade that comes out, which it looks like some kind of thing from like M.C. Escher's Bad Nightmare or something.
It flies
down the hallways and embeds itself in people's foreheads. And then through the course of the film, you have these three guys who are friends, and in this case, brothers, two of them. And then their buddy, Reggie the Ice Cream Man, and they're battling the Tall Man.
Yes.
And essentially, every movie, in a certain sense, is that same exact premise.
Mm-hmm.
Reggie and Michael fight the Tall Man again and again in different places and different times and different space. It's persisted through five movies.
And I'd say this is an interesting series simply for the fact that it's probably one of the more original ideas or more sci-fi ideas in horror movies, like as a franchise. I don't think I've seen a like good sci-fi franchise, horror franchise that's this kind of far out there in terms of like going to different dimensions and doing all this kind of stuff.
Yes, not so consistently in that this movie, you made a good point, the story has very dreamlike feel to it. And
yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily say that all of these films are cohesive, but I will say that they do follow up on each other. It's not like telling a brand new story every time. It's not like the Jason series or the Freddy series where
mm-hmm.
one movie throws away everything that happened in the previous one and then moves forward. There is a certain kind of dream logic that persists through all five movies.
And yet, if you were to, like, say, watch them, someone or like fall asleep for a short amount of time and wake up, you would still be just as aware of what's going on
you
as someone who has watched the entire thing. the whole way through.
Something dawned on me after watching like all of them that like you could essentially probably watch each one individually, and it would be like watching a new Phantasm just redone every time.
In rebooted
a sense, even though they are building off of each other, they're essentially the same theme revisited in about five different phases. Phantasm comes out in 1979, a year after Halloween, John Carpenter's Halloween. And I'm assuming that probably this was still a time where probably a lot of people were seeing a movie like this at the drive-in. I saw
it. Oh, this would be a great drive-in kind of film. Yeah.
Yeah, it has that kind of ambiance and that feel. It's very, very 70s, even though it's coming at the very end of the 70s.
And didn't you originally say, though, that it was originally like rated X or something?
Yes, for a very short amount of time. I believe they were saying that it was rated X because there is a scene in the film, this isn't really giving anything away, where one of those balls, the first time it shows up, embeds itself in somebody's forehead and you have blood gushing out of his head. At the same time, now you and I were uncertain this is even what was happening, but there's urine sort of dripping out on the ground on the guy's leg and he falls down. And that was graphic enough to nab the movie an X rating, but I think what we have to remember is that an X rating is essentially what the NC-17 rating became. So Taxi Driver was rated X in its day.
That one puzzles, that boggles the mind.
I think it was because there's a thing. It was just enough to push over beyond an R. Now, you and I would watch Phantasm now and think it would be probably actually just about a mild R.
Yeah.
Really. Not anything very excessive. There was a film critic who saw it who really enjoyed it, and I think he was in the minority at the time of film critics who, but he saw something very dreamlike and very artsy in a sense in it. And he, I think, maybe called in a couple of favors and managed to get the rating overturned back to an R, which is where it probably rightfully belongs.
Yeah.
I didn't see this movie until many years later, which is good because I was just being born in 1979. What did you think of this movie the first time you saw it, the original Phantasm? Let's do the first time, well, and then we can talk about our rewatch.
The first time I watched it, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was cool. I was really boggled by it. I was very confused what was kind of going on. I really liked the elements of the tall man and as just like a force of nature almost, an evil force. And like the silver spheres were great. And I liked that it was really a sci-fi movie about this invader from another dimension coming in and trying to like take over in a way. I kind of liked certain elements about it. I didn't think it was amazing, but at the same time, I was sort of fascinated by Angus Scrimm and his "I'll get you, boy," you know, personality. Like nothing would stop him. I thought it was cool. And then several years later, I ended up watching like the sequel, the second one, and that's where I thought this might be an interesting franchise. I need to catch up and watch all of them because it's so different and so bizarre. Like I think it's as a movie series, it's interesting. You at least have to say that. And that, for me, a lot of times, I just want to watch something I haven't seen before that's new or refreshing or has interesting ideas. And that definitely was this. So, I never did actually catch up on watching the rest of them until we decided to do this retrospective, but...
Yeah, I saw it, seeing it the first time when I was younger, what mostly stuck in my head were, like you said, images. And I think at the time that the movie came out, why it was made on a very small budget, I think that's the thing to remember is Coscarelli made it very cheaply. I mean, to be honest, he's made all the movies very cheaply. He's definitely working in an independent vein, in a sense, when he made it. And he'd only made two other movies before this, and they were both essentially like what I would say almost be kids' movies. Kids' movies in the sense that they were movies about young kids, and they were sort of slice-of-life, coming-of-age stories. And that's not to say that in one way, the Phantasm movie from 79 is not really a coming-of-age story. It kind of is, in a certain sense. Coscarelli makes it on a low budget. But I think that one of the things that was true of horror movies in that time period, because in that time period, when these movies came out, most of them were regarded by the critical media and by people who had a certain idea of what horror movies should be, you know, good horror movies. They would look at a lot of these movies that released somewhere between the late 70s and the late 80s, and even some of the early 90s. And basically just dismiss them as garbage, violent trash that people shouldn't be watching. And kind of ignoring the fact that even so, though some of these movies were not very good, they did have some really interesting imagery. Like kind of memorable, fascinating imagery. The same kind of thing that you would find in sort of underground art from that same time period, you know, kind of graphic artists, comic book artists, images and stuff that you would find there, you were finding in some of these movies. Look at the Pinhead image. We've talked about that before, like Clive Barker, Hellraiser, the image with the cross-section head with all the pins in it. Very like, that's stark, a fascinating image. Even the first time Freddy Krueger shows up with that bladed glove. Like, those are horrifying but very stylish images.
Yes.
They're no less stylish than Karloff's Frankenstein or Bela Lugosi's vampire. I mean, they're very different across time, but they still, there was something kind of fresh and interesting in the images. Then watching Phantasm, that's kind of what I remember. The ball flying down the hallway, the tall man, the little creatures running behind the tombstones. Something about Phantasm that's always been interesting all through the movies, and we can see that, there's a very heavy emphasis on death imagery. And I don't mean gore or violence, but literally the accoutrements of the dead. I mean, the tall man is an undertaker.
Half the movie takes place in some sort of...
dwarves essentially are corpses, you know, we've come to find out. The ball with its shiny blades looks like a surgical instrument, really. It has that kind of antiseptic sort of feel of something you would see in a surgeon's office or in a morgue used to cut bodies open. And
sort of mummify you by removing all
lots of Phantasm liquids. Takes place inside of mausoleums or mortuaries, which is a little different than a lot of other series, I think, which kind of makes sense when we look at the story of the first movie. Like, as you had started to kind of allude to, it deals with a boy who seems to be dealing with his brother's about to leave town, and he it seems to be his brother's about all that he has. It's hard to really tell because are their parents with him? Are their parents not? It was always kind of difficult to see. And it seems like his brother's the only person in his life, although I believe one of the later movies we see him driving with his parents to a funeral, and I'm confused. And I'm like,
that's right.
What's going on?
I believe that was the fourth one.
Yes. So there's a lot of changes. Part of this might be due to the fact that Coscarelli, when he finished it, he had a 3.5-hour cut of this movie.
Now, that would have been a fascinating Phantasm.
It would have been fascinating. I wonder if it would have made it through it. But when he cut it down to about, like, 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. No, maybe less, like 80 minutes. It's a pretty swift movie, the original. And it does deal, it jumps right into its story. We see their friend is murdered by, essentially, the tall man, disguised as a woman.
I like to call her the tall girl, although I think she has a different
name. I think she's like the Lady in Red or something.
Lady in Lavender
Lady in Lavender. Lady in Red is a song. But, yes. And one minute he's with the Lady in Lavender, and the next minute it's a tall man. And it's like Angus Scrimm looking up at him. That's got to be a bad experience.
Yes.
And then he's murdered. And they are at his funeral. That's about the time that Michael, who's played by...
A.
Michael Baldwin. See, it's easy to remember most of the names in this movie because Reggie, the ice cream man, is their friend. The ponytailed ice cream man is played by Reggie Bannister.
Yes.
And now Jody is played by Bill Thornberry. So they must have decided that Bill could handle having someone else call his name a different name than his own, and he would respond to it. And then, of course, Scrimm is the tall man. And then on the version that we watched recently when we rewatched it, they have that weird opening where Angus Scrimm comes on, sits down, and like almost a Masterpiece Theater sort of thing, discusses how...
That, to me, was honestly like the greatest point of the movie because it was a great introduction. And just seeing him like joyfully talk about his role was fantastic.
Like, yeah, and his story that he tells.
I was like, oh, I was told this was I was going to be an alien, and I thought to myself, oh, a man who's traveled from a distant land doesn't quite fit in.
Would I be Irish or German? Yeah. And he's from another planet. And he was like, oh. But must have clicked, because he did four more.
Yes.
He appears shortly after their friend's funeral. The little creatures appear, and then they start
scamper
attacking.
After Michael in the graveyard.
They attack Michael at one point. They attack Jody. Jody ends up trying to hook up with the Lady in Lavender and gets the tall man. And in
the creepiest scene ever, Michael's in the woods because he's following his brother everywhere. And he's just like, woo, when he sees
He comes upon them frolicking. Eventually, it becomes, again, your typical horror movie where they're clearly kind of fighting this dark, ghoulish character, the tall man. And the dwarves become a little more prominent, and then they find the big secret of the movie, which you still can't quite put in a plausible context, which is
that the dwarves themselves are shrunken down bodies of dead people.
Reanimated bodies. Crunch
down reanimated bodies. And get this, for a very specific purpose, because of the gravity on the home planet they're being sent to was so high, they had to be crushed down. It was ridiculous.
He's on our Earth crunching down bodies so he can turn them into intergalactic slaves. Pack mules.
Yes!
Really, because, and his mode of transportation are these dimensional gates that basically just look like those...
Like just metal poles.
Metal poles, like you see at the theater where they usually have the...
The tape stretched in between them. Yeah.
That was basically the portal. And they'll go in between the portal. And there's a scene where Michael or Reggie or somebody is thrown through the portal, partially through the portal, and sees this red barren planet. Looks like something from Dune. Yes. Dune is referenced a couple times in the movie.
I noticed as we were watching it, and I missed that entirely the first time, but there's a lot of Dune references.
One of the hotels is called Dune or something like that.
It was a bar. I think it was like a bar or something called Dune. And then, of course, there was a scene with like the creepy grandma in the, like, she was going to tell his fortune or something. And she's like, here, put your hand in this black box. And I was like, that is literally ripping straight from Frank Herbert.
The fear box. Yes. Like, basically, she's like a Bene Gesserit. She's there talking to him.
And she's like, are you a man?
And who that lady is and where she goes is also kind of like up for, I never really certain.
I think they implied that she may have been the tall man's wife in the fourth one. But I'm not entirely sure.
I'm not sure what was implied there. But yet,
I'm sure someone on the internet will tell us.
Maybe. So. I think this one's even befuddled the internet a little bit. But so eventually they fight the tall man in the mortuary. I believe they kill him. In the original cut, it's a little different that I think Michael uses a fire extinguisher and sort of freezes him a little bit because they come to realize that the tall man is apprehensive about cold. Cold sort of bothers him, which is a theme that kind of runs through the movie. Sometimes.
You think that Reggie would like pick up on it at some point because he's the ice cream
and lock
man.
Him in. Well, that is sort of how they determine it, but I can't remember.
It was just because they saw him walk past Reggie and he had like the door open in the back of the truck and he saw the cold air coming out and he was like, "Arr!" And like scampers away.
Yeah, it's just sort of an implication in one of the movies. They do defeat the tall man. They go back home. Reggie is killed.
Yes.
Jody.
By the tall girl.
Jody and Michael survive. Reggie is killed. They go home. Then Michael wakes up and Jody is dead, died in a car accident, has been dead for a couple of weeks. And Reggie is now like his caregiver, basically.
Yeah.
And is talking, you've had a hard time dealing with Jody's death. And I know this has been hard on you. And that's kind of the wrap up of the movie, except that when Michael goes upstairs and starts to go to bed, he closes the door and the tall man is there and screams, "Boy!" And then
him through the glass.
Yeah, one of the dwarves grabs him, and that's the end of the movie. So it ends just like a dream. The whole thing makes very, very little sense. This is a wildly...
And yet more sense than most of, like, any of the other sequels.
Well, it's a wildly incoherent movie in a lot of ways, but it does have a sense of a dream to it. Like, individual scenes, like we talked about, are very fascinating. The way the little creatures move back and forth between the tombstones, you get glimpses of them and weird growls on the soundtrack. And there's a weird disconnection between what you're seeing a lot of times. When one of them attacks him, it's almost like being attacked by a panther or something, you know? Yeah, like, it's like on his back, like a wild beast. And it just, the way the film is shot, the way it is presented, and the way it's edited, and this might be because it was such a longer movie, we are introduced to characters who have agendas, but we don't know their motivation or their context for what they're doing.
Yeah, they just kind of pop in and then they're gone.
Particularly with the tall man. Now, I heard that originally it was going to be about an hour or more before you met the tall man in the original movie. And the idea was that you would be guessing what kind of genre the movie was in and not actually know. I mean, now, if it was called Phantasm, probably figure out it was a horror film, and I'm sure it marketed that way. But initially, it wasn't really supposed to be known that it was a horror film until the tall man enters the story. And originally, when they were originally doing this, Reggie Bannister approached Don Coscarelli, and they wanted to make a Something Wicked This Way Comes movie, based off of the Ray Bradbury book that features this Mr. Dark, who has a carnival, which he has his own diminutive little
minions
that follow him around. And the whole carnival story, they come into town and they're sort of possessing the townsfolk, kind of bringing them over to the dark side, if you will. That was what they wanted to do. But about the time that they were talking about making the film is at the point when Bradbury sold the rights to Something Wicked This Way Comes to Disney. So they decided to do a different story with some similar elements, which I think is fair. You can kind of see that in the movie. But I don't... I don't respond to Phantasm as a story really at all. But I don't think that's really what Coscarelli's going for. Like, I don't think that's what's effective about the first movie. It's more of just a weird experience. It is like having a dream,
kind of,
if you will. And I think that that idea that it's almost like a little boy's dream of dealing with death and dealing with acceptance of death kind of fits the movie pretty well. Like, I feel like that's a reasonable, acceptable premise. It doesn't feel like a cop-out if you apply it to just the first movie.
Yeah. And I think when you mentioned earlier, towards the beginning of the conversation, when you were mentioning the interesting visuals and stuff, like, that is one of my favorite parts, is where you see the Michael fall through the portal and go to that other world, well, at least half his body's hanging through, and he sees a long line of, like, little dead midget men going off to their destination. I was like, that's just a cool fantasy visual. And it's just really interesting. It's kind of stuck with me for a long time.
It is an interesting shot. One thing that's interesting in it from a film kind of historical perspective is you can kind of see some of the influences, though, that Coscarelli's pulling from. Mm-hmm. And it's weird to say this. I know I mentioned it to you. I don't know what you think about it. But in some ways, Phantasm is like a weird, cracked horror version of The Wizard of Oz.
I could see that. Yeah.
I mean, they both end with the classic, it was just a dream kind of element. They both are basically dealing with the entire journey is suggested to be the protagonist's way of dealing with their life and dealing with growing up and dealing with difficult things that they have to. For The Wizard of Oz, it is Dorothy coming to grips with who she is and where she is and her and the people around her. And in Phantasm, it's Michael coming to grips with death. And you can almost see how that would work with Mike if we were to kind of figure that this is the weird dream in between Michael dealing with Jody's death. You can see how all of these elements would evolve. This young boy goes to his brother's funeral, and he's caught up in all this imagery. Maybe Angus Scrimm is the guy who's actually heading up, you know, he's the undertaker at the funeral home, and he becomes a guardian or a gatekeeper of the dead, which is sort of what he is in a sense. And then the Jawa creatures, the little dwarves, are basically representing that when you die, or perhaps Michael's fear of when you die, is that you basically become, death robs us of our individuality. We all become faceless and distorted.
That's a good point.
And deformed, and we're all kind of robbed of our individuality. And then in a sense, when that scene where they're like slaves going across that barren world, two movies came to mind. One, of course, The Wizard of Oz, when the lion and the scarecrow and the tin man are trying to rescue Dorothy and they see the soldiers marching to the witch's castle and that, oh, we go, you know, where they're all marching together. But then the end of Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. Did you ever see The Seventh Seal? When they look on the horizon and they see death playing his flute and marching all of the like lost souls across the hillside. Like, has the same kind of weird, kind
very
of impersonal, sad, melancholy, but also kind of fascinating image. So, and a lot of old medieval art, there's some of that kind of feel and some of Phantasm. So I feel like you could almost interpret the movie that way. Of course, even the tall man, the way he has these like little phrases, like the boy is probably the biggest distillation of I'll get you my pretty you could possibly do. He's reduced it to a single word, but he imbues it with that much menace. In a sense, too, even like the Wicked Witch of the West ends up being allergic to something very mundane and simple, which is kind of what they're implying when the tall man is allergic to the cold. That even though he appears to be this great, horrible force, they're able to deal with him in a mundane way. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of my thoughts on it. I think that there's enough going on. It's an interesting movie.
I feel it's definitely the best of the series.
Yeah, it has a lot of personality. You can watch it, and I think you can appreciate it as something unique. And it feels a little fresh, but I don't think it would have. I don't know if it would have worked in a 3-hour format.
I think it'd like be you're one just of those about things, done with. Yeah, it. Like I would be interested to see it for the sake of like what would this have been if it was 3 hours. But I definitely don't think I'd be popping that in more than once.
Yeah, I'm glad I saw Phantasm, and I've always been glad to have seen it and that it existed. And I think for Coscarelli, it was a nice jumping off point. But to be fair, he hasn't done a ton of stuff. I think his next movie after Phantasm was Beastmaster, which was sort of like a Conan the Barbarian,
kind of.
I don't say ripoff, but a spinoff of when the Sword and Sandal movies were popular. As Sword and Sandal movies go, Beastmaster's not bad. I enjoyed it, the original.
Yeah, it's watchable.
I think he did one more movie called, was it Survival Quest? And then I think he did, or I think before Survival Quest, same year Survival Quest, he did Phantasm 2.
Which came back 9 years after Phantasm 1.
Yeah.
Now, this one really stumps me, Phantasm 2. I'm not quite sure what to do with it. It's a movie that, it definitely has a story arc. But this, out of all of them especially, I feel like when I mentioned before, like, falling asleep and waking up, and you'd still be probably okay, not needing to know all of the things that have happened up to that point.
Well, I can attest to that, because I did that while we were watching Phantasm 2.
Phantasm 2 especially has that very dreamlike quality. Like, it starts off, and you're not really sure, Reggie's back all of a sudden. Like, where did that come from? And now Reggie has, like, family members coming over. Although in Phantasm 2, later it was implied it was something else. But in Phantasm 2, it was, like, his aunt and niece or something like that.
I've thought about that. I don't know if what he's saying to Michael is your aunt and niece, the way I would say to my nephews, your Aunt Jen. But I'm referring to my wife.
You know what? That's a good point. I didn't even think about that. That's absolutely... That would make a lot more sense.
But because Reggie seems to be single...
Seems like at the same time, Reggie kind of sees Michael as a brother more than just a caregiver. I feel like their relationship is a little different. So, like, that's probably why I didn't even think about him talking about it that way.
I don't know. I agree with you. It's strange. I think one of the things that's strange... Well, there's lots of things strange about Phantasm, too. The 9 years later, but it also takes up exactly after Phantasm 1.
Yes, it does.
And almost all of them, with the exception of a couple, exception of really two of them, end with that weird, it's just a dream, something jumps out and grabs you classic horror movie ending. But each movie has to go to great lengths to undo that ending. So
it is very strange.
Sort of ignore it, and I'm wondering why they did it even after the first one. Like, after the first one, I'm perfectly happy, as I just mentioned, with the resolution that this is all Michael's dream. I mean, the one more twist of having the tall man doesn't even necessarily prove to me it's not Michael's dream. It just means that overcoming your fear of death is always prominent. It's always present. Mm-hmm. But when you pick up that way, Reggie's now 9 years older. Michael is played by a completely different actor.
Yes.
He's now James LaGrosse, who has gone on to have a somewhat of a career. But he's, you know, A. Michael Baldwin's out. But James LaGrosse is only in this one movie playing Michael. The other thing I think that's how we have to kind of address is 9 years later. When Phantasm comes out, now when we look at it, and when back in the day when I would go to the video store, it would be sitting on the shelves like everything else. So it was really just one more horror franchise. You know, what's the difference between Phantasm and Hellraiser and Jason Michael Myers and all that? And from a pure perspective, everyone's like, this is just one more piece of crap sitting on the video store shelf. But Phantasm, to be fair, preceded all of them except for Michael Myers, except for Halloween. He preceded Nightmare on Elm Street. He preceded, I'm thinking of the tall man. The tall man preceded Freddy Krueger. He preceded Jason Voorhees by a few years. Preceded Pinhead. But 9 years, these other franchises were getting busy because in 1988, when Phantasm 2 comes out, it's just the second movie. And in 1979, the movie feels very original because we haven't had a lot of that weird, disorienting, dream-centered horror. I think we're on to, like, Friday the 13th, part 5 or something by 88.
Wow.
5 or 6. Like, honestly, there were that many of those. And there wasn't even
one.
There wasn't even one around.
Saw-style, one every year.
Just about. It was up there. Nightmare on Elm Street 4 was coming out in 1988. So there was also 4 of those, and this is a series that wasn't even around when Phantasm around. Halloween was on its 4th incarnation, 4th or 5th by 88.
Wow.
So all of these franchises have been rolling. So Phantasm now looks like the late to the party kind of sequel, and it just blends in. Poltergeist 3.
It sure does blend in. Poltergeist 3. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Well, and I mentioned Poltergeist series because the first one aside, 2 and 3... bring in a character, Kane, who is very similar to the tall man in some ways. He's another creepy oldster, like, who goes around.
I would have liked to have seen the tall man do a few, like, psalms or whatever.
Yes. But, yeah, he sings weird old spirituals.
Oh, the Lord's in his temple.
Yeah. And again, Hellraiser was even on its sequel. And Hellraiser was only a year or so earlier, you know.
Wow.
So, by the time Phantasm 2 comes to the table, I think it's also competing with that. It has a bigger budget. Universal's behind it. It's got some backing now. It's not the little independent movie anymore. It's not a giant budget movie, but it's meant to go into the theater and be a horror franchise.
Yeah.
And I think it tries too hard to be like these other movies. I think it's trying a little too hard to be similar to, particularly similar to Nightmare on Elm Street and Hellraiser a little bit, I feel like.
I could see that influence, yeah.
It's, you mentioned dreamlike, but I feel like this movie feels more incoherent and less dreamlike. Like, there was a dream logic sense to the original Phantasm, where even if we didn't have every scene, we got the basic gist that this is what's going on, that nightmare feel. In Phantasm 2, there's a sense of a whole bunch of stuff just being flung together without a good understanding of why it goes together. Like, I feel like this movie is really just a bunch of images and a lot of repetition.
You're not wrong about that at all. Like, that's a great, just to say that, that's perfect, spot on. That's literally kind of what it feels like to me, because that's really the only things that stand out about that movie to me is some of the weird images in it. Nothing else really kind of makes an impression on me.
What was your favorite part of Phantasm 2?
Probably the strangest part, and I think it's twofold. One, because the part where they roll into like the first town and they're looking for the tall man, we're going to kick his butt.
And I guess we, even though there's very little plot, I guess we should shut up and just say that basically, Reggie and Michael go on the road to fight the tall man because they both lost people at this point.
Reggie's explodes. They're going back to Reggie's house. Reggie, on their way back, they see Reggie's house explode.
Reggie's house explodes twice before in the first 10 minutes of the movie.
They're like, all right, I guess it's time to go hit the road then and fight this tall man. You know, let's make it
and
a
Michael, which is, here's where I see the nightmare before, I mean, Nightmare Before Christmas. No, the Nightmare on Elm Street thing kick in, is Michael is now connected psychically to this other girl.
Without any explanation as to
how. We don't know why they are, but they're special in some way, and they both are linked to the tall man. Mm-hmm. And they have visions of the tall man, they have visions of each other, and the tall man is interested in them in some way. Which is very much like the Dream Warriors, the Nightmare on Elm Street 3. Like, I feel like that's why it's there. It's not there because Coscarelli had a compelling idea for it. It's just there. Yeah. So they're on the road, they're going to fight the tall man.
And they go into their first, like, big cemetery or whatever, and they crawl across all the graves which have been opened up, and then they go into the actual, like, mausoleum. And the things that strike me are, one, the image is just gross craziness of, like, the girl, she's covered in a cloth, so they're like, who's this in a cloth? They rip the cloth off, and they see this girl. It's like, oh, I've been dreaming about you, Liz. Oh, I can't, you know, I'm so glad to see you. And then, like, you see out of her back, like, thing pops out, like a second creature kind of, like, pops out. It's, like, gross. It's like, I'll get you yet, boy.
It's a little puppety thing. It's a tall man.
And it was, like, gross. And I was like, and I thought to myself, this is the second part that gets me, and this is just because it's hilarious to me. The tall man put all this time and effort just to taunt Michael by putting like a creature inside someone's back just to be like, I'll get you yet, boy, or, you know, whatever.
Well, I think that's the interesting thing, that the tall man has several opportunities to kill Michael or Reggie, and he just doesn't do either.
As a villain, he's terrible at it because he just won't destroy his opposition.
Well, there also seems to be a question, too. It's sort of like he wants dead bodies, which is kind of why, as the movies become a little more apocalyptic, you're sort of like, why? Like, would the tall man stealing dead bodies, if he doesn't need anybody else, who really cares? But he seems to want to kill living people too, but if he gets the dead bodies and he just wants to take them off to another world, you know, it means we don't have less people to bury. But, which I don't know why he wants fresh ones.
Because, hey, you got the crappy rotting ones that have been in the ground for years and years and years.
They seem probably to come not out as the same old.
I don't know. I think they're probably not monster. As strong.
I don't know.
They probably can't carry as much stuff as pack mules on the other planet. I don't know.
But there's no explanation. In fact, that entire plot line about him being the intergalactic monster who is basically making an army of slaves is dropped in a line or two here, but has very little bearing on what happens in this
movie. Yes, because the slave angle kind of goes away after a while.
They're really just his minions helping him do whatever it is he's doing, which literally
seems to
be,
which we never really get to until, I guess, the fifth one, probably.
So what he's doing in this movie just seems to be, he's there to pop out from behind things and thwart Michael and Reggie, and that's basically it. I've heard people say that, and I think Coscarelli says it's like the action Phantasm, but I actually think the movie drags a lot. There's very little.
Yeah, this one's not the action Phantasm in my book. Yeah. I don't think any of them could really call at the action Phantasm.
Coscarelli's too interested in, again, that imagery, and it's funny because Roger Ebert, when he reviewed the movie in 1988, like he was not very kind to it, but he mentioned, like, was like, well, who is this movie really for? It's just a lot of images of graves and rotting corpses and dead things. Who's enjoying that kind of imagery? And he said, well, maybe it's teenagers who think they can live forever. But teenagers one day grow into adults, but there will always be new teenagers. And maybe that's who the Phantasm movies are for. And that's kind of reductive, but I don't think that's necessarily wrong for this movie. I'm not a big fan of this movie. The only thing I like about this movie, really, is that it kind of does puts Reggie Bannister kind of front and center. It establishes him as a character and a
driving
force.
He drops off as being the ice cream man, and now he's a warrior.
Well, he's this old hippie dude with a ponytail and a yes. four-barrel shotgun. This is where Reggie was not much of a character in the first movie. He's just sort of a side person.
I'll help you guys do whatever you need to do.
Yeah, he's the buddy, and the ice cream man imagery is kind of interesting, but like, it becomes Reggie's series in the second movie.
Absolutely.
LaGrosse is not doing anything interesting with Michael, and Michael's not that interesting of a character, particularly in the second movie. Mm-hmm. And no one else is either. You have a couple of... isn't there a female character, Alchemy, who's the girl that he hooks up with in this film?
Some hippie chick.
Well, yeah, and anyone who's watching The Flash knows that the new villain of the season is Alchemy. But it is a character from the comics, Dr. Alchemy or something like that, which is what I thought of when I saw this. But you've got these elements, but it becomes a very by-the-numbers sort of like horror movie where you've got gross imagery, you've got things popping out, and not a lot of common sense story-wise in between. There's this whole plot line where too much time is spent on a local country church that is where Liz is living. Liz, mm-hmm. who's this person that Michael's psychically linked to. This priest who seems to be picking up on the fact that the tall man is trying to assimilate his congregation. And they have that line where the priest is talking to the tall man. The tall man says, when you die, you don't go to heaven. You come to us. Like, mm-hmm. there's this whole feeling of, again, of an existential crisis or something. Or some dark idea that beyond death lies nothing. Or lies worse than nothing. And not much is done with that, really. Like, it seems like it's intended to be a whole subplot. Like, we're supposed to kind of, like, not identify with the priest, but the priest is supposed to be some kind of pivotal character, like a different viewpoint from which to see the tall man and what he's doing. A way to take it out of it just being in Michael's head or Liz's head, like to take it away from being a dream. But it doesn't really work.
Mm-mm. No, and I think another distinction with Phantasm 2 is this is one where we finally get to see a little bit more of, like, the weird toys at the disposal of the tall man. Like, his fears, which are prominently displayed on all the posters. Like, it's the biggest thing about the movie series. It could be just the weird mashup of watching all the movies, but I thought in the first one we may have seen a glimpse or two of a golden ball that was flying around. But it finally actually pops out and does stuff in the Phantasm 2, and he shows you that it's like a completely different thing than the other ones are. And like
is
blows
it the second
stuff
one
up.
That it shows up in?
No, I think it shows up like just you see glimpses of it in the first one, I think. I could be way off on that.
They're all blending together a little
exactly.
bit.
Exactly. Like, I'm not entirely sure if I'm seeing the right thing.
Well, I think 2 was the
again,
movie
something
that had...
on the something someone on the internet will correct me about.
Did the ball fly in the first one, or he just stick it in
I think it just
head?
Flew. I just think it just flew past somebody or something.
Yeah,
I could very well be
part
off.
Part 2.
2 is where it really actually does anything.
Yeah.
And it was, like, kind of weird because, you have your first silver ball, and it just kind of drills into your head and sucks your juices out, kind of like to pre-embalm you or something, like, to set you up for an embalming. But this one, like, had lasers. It would blow stuff up with lasers and, like, could dig through you. It was like a saw of some sort to, like, chaw through you. So I think it was kind of fun for film to people who were like down with the silver balls from the first one. They're like, wow, these are kind of awesome. You get a little bit more of that. And then it gets crazier as the series progresses. But here's where you get your first taste of like things are changing with the technology. You see the toy man has some other tricks up his sleeve. Or the tall man has some other tricks up his sleeve that are cool.
And then at the end, it all kind of comes back around. They fight him again. They defeat him again. He's gorier and grosser.
Yes.
It's more like The Wizard of Oz. He melts down.
Yes, he does.
And then I think in this one, the dwarves carry his dead. Or the tall man comes out and throws his dead carcass back through the gate.
He does.
Yeah, so it's like, oh, so there's another tall man out there. He's like a video game. He'll come back and he can just take out the last life and dump it back down the drain. And then it ends again. Reggie seems to have succeeded, but again, his proclivities get the best of him. And Alchemy, he's there trying to mac with Alchemy. The kids are in the back of the hearse. And then, you know, next thing we see, Reggie is falling down the side of the hearse outside of it. And the tall man grabs Michael and Liz, and the movie ends.
Yep.
for another, what, like, several years? What is it, 94 before we see 94, another?
94, yeah, that right on the nose. 94 is when the next one pops out. And this one, I kind of like this one. It was because the tone had changed. I feel like, because this one now is definitely more Mad Max apocalyptic. It's called Phantasm III Lord of the Dead, this one. And by the time it starts up, it's, yes, it does its resolution of the ending of the second movie, which, again, they take a little bit of time to develop that, and then they get past it. And then all of a sudden, it's like you could see the tall man, like, attacking and destroying towns and stuff in the second one. And you're like, this is kind of weird that no one's responding to this. Well, by the time the third one rolls around, it seems like everyone's gone. There's very few people around, and it's affected
the entire world, in a sense.
It's turned into, like, a weird Mad Max sort of existence.
Because we don't just get the tall man in that in this movie. I mean, we get the tall man. There are also characters that I think start to spring up in the second movie. We mentioned the dwarves, the balls, and the tall man. There's another element, which are, like, the people digging the graves. His, like,
gravers. Henchmen,
the gravers, I guess, which are kind of weird, steampunky-looking things that wear, like, gas masks. And we're not really sure who they are. Do we know?
Just assistants of his.
I mean, but
I really don't know.
I mean, they've got the dwarves. They're for the other realm.
Maybe they're just more from dead his dimension or something.
I don't feel like we ever see one close enough. They're clearly mutated in some way. Mm-hmm. But they're never exactly explained who they are. I guess if we're doing the allegory of the Wizard of Oz, they would be more like the Tinky Soldiers. And the dwarves are more like his flying monkeys.
Yes, that's a good example.
But really, we don't know who they are. They pop up in the second movie. They're there in the third movie. The third movie didn't come to theaters. I think it maybe came to one or two theaters, but it was really a direct-to-video kind of deal. And then it's funny because we talked about those trends. It's coming out all the time with the sequels. The year it comes out, we're starting to finally see, like, direct-to-VHS is what it was at the time. Mm-hmm. Direct-to-video was something that was starting to happen with some horror movies. I think that in those years you had, like... that year was the year that Leprechaun started getting its sequels. And
we're going to have to do a retrospective at some point on that.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. So with Leprechaun had a good number of sequels. I think Leprechaun has more movies than Phantasm to its...
It does.
Under its belt. Six, I think. Seven, if you count that remake.
I don't count that one.
Okay, fair enough. Still more in the original series. But Leprechaun 2, there was a Pumpkinhead 2, which Pumpkinhead ended up having about four movies.
Yeah.
I mean, none of these really fantastic stuff, but... their sequels. Phantasm Lord of the Dead's interesting because it is a direct-to-video sequel, but in a lot of ways it feels much more polished and much more bigger budget than the two movies that came before it.
Yeah.
And it's probably more coherent than the two movies that came before it.
Mm-hmm. This one has like a much more standard kind of narrative to it.
And at this point, two things have happened. Reggie is now the main character.
Officially.
Like, pretty much officially the main character.
Yes.
That kind of flip-flops later in the series, but he becomes clear that he's, like, the center of it. And it's become a horror comedy, really.
Yes.
Like,
this is the second one where Reggie tells a girl, it's kind of hard on the road for a man.
But not for the last time, does he say it. And so this movie, he's teamed up with this murderous little kid that's, like, the hell seed of Home Alone.
Yes.
Like, and they do encounter, like I say, it's not just the tall man, it's not just his minions and his henchmen, it's also...
Everyone
who's kind of lost their mind, you know, the riffraff that are taking advantage of this being the apocalypse and preying on people. So Reggie gets hijacked by some people early on, and that's when he meets the kid who has a...
Again, Reggie, by just being a scumbag, like, being, oh, this...
A scumbag with a heart of gold.
Yeah.
He means well. He has that frisbee with the razor blades attached. The kid throws him out, and it's like
a scene reminiscent of the Road Warrior, almost.
Yeah, it's some Road Warrior, some Sam Raimi thrown in there, and these are still in 94, still a time when these movies are cult classics to some people. But you know, referencing a Raimi movie or something wasn't going to be like instantly recognizable to everybody. Exactly right. Jody comes back, and he's a ball now.
Yes,
and we don't really know
why.
He's
a ball.
He is
one of the spheres.
He is. He morphs into Jody once in a while, and we have Bill Thornberry back. A. Michael Baldwin is now back. James LaGrosse is out again. And A. Michael Baldwin is, like, really not in this movie that much. Like, Michael is sort of, like, sidelined because he's, like, taken by the tall man.
Yeah.
So tall man has him somewhere. we're starting to realize that the tall man has some kind of weird affinity for him. I'm not really certain. There's a weird line in this movie, not a, like an actual dialogue line, but just a weird through line that seems to almost be going like, I'm waiting for the tall man to basically be like Darth Vader and admit that he's like Michael's father or something. Like, there's this sense that he has some affinity to him. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, he's got him on the table. At one point, the tall man starts to dig into his head, and we realize that there's a silver ball sticking out of Michael's head. And we're never certain. I'm still not to this day certain, after seeing all the movies, whether he's putting the ball in or bringing it out. And it was already in there.
Yeah, I really don't know either.
I mean, it's a weird effect. Reggie goes on the road with the kid and with Rocky.
Rocky, who, yes.
Who's like the spunky African-American chick with nunchucks, I think, in the beginning.
Nunchucks,
when she first meets him, she is...
And an Uzi or
defeating
something.
One of the balls with the nunchucks. And they all go on the road together. Predictably, Reggie tries to get his groove on. And predictably is...
Rocky denies.
Yes, denied. I think he comes on saying, hey, baby, you want some vanilla? And she says something like, dairy products, give me gas. Or something like that. I don't remember exactly. But then they fight the tall man again. They have another big battle. We have CGI spheres flying around.
Yes.
It's like someone did it in like After Effects. Mm. And the tall man reveals he has hundreds of these balls. I think we also get the implication that the brains are out of the dwarves and the brains go into the balls.
Yes. They had a scene where he's like putting a brain inside one of those balls.
So the ball has the brain and the sentience, I guess, flying around. And the body is just like a
shell of some
sort. That's weird because I think that this is where this stuff starts to feel very like Doctor Who-esque. Like,
kind of, yeah.
Like the weird time-shifting alien who's making this army. And they fight the tall man again. They seemingly win this time because we find the gold ball.
Yes, yet again, inside the tall man.
Yeah, so it's like that's his spirit animal is the gold ball. It busts right out of his head.
My Patronus is a gold ball.
Yeah, and so they defeat him in the original ending of the movie, I think, where Coscarelli's just going to say, hey, what if we wrap this whole series up and just ended it, you know? Like, why would anyone ever do that? But he and the boy go and bury the ball, like, in Siberia or something, somewhere in like, Alaska, somewhere cold. They bury it down the ground, and they say something like, guess all we have to worry about now is global warming, and, like, walk away. Da-da-da. But that's not the ending of the movie. Reggie gets slammed against the wall by a bunch of balls, which, when I first saw the movie, I assumed that they had pinned him with their blades and have him pinned against the wall. And then the little dwarves grab the little boy, pull him through the mirror. Tall man's there. End of the movie. What is it? How many years? 3 years?
It is 1998.
98. So we are at least shrinking in how long it takes for things to get out.
Only temporarily.
That's true.
Because the very next one is huge jump.
Phantasm 4 is... At this point,
now this
time
this is also the last Phantasm that was written and directed by Don Coscarelli. So this was the last one he could truly say is his baby, kind of in a way. I don't know.
Yeah, Coscarelli, he makes it in 98. I didn't see this one immediately because again, this was a point when it was strictly coming to
VHS,
and it was straight to video. It was not coming to theaters.
Oblivion. Phantasm 4 Oblivion.
And I've always meant to see it. I just hadn't for a few years. It was some years later that I did see it. One of the things, I guess, that was notable about it when it was coming out was that Coscarelli, this is when we really came to realize that Coscarelli had made the movie, they made the original movie with so much footage, with like 3 hours of footage.
Yes.
Lost a lot of it, but apparently still had some of it because a lot of it goes, or a chunk of it, goes into Phantasm Oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
We hear that, oh, there's going to be a lot more footage of Reggie and Michael and Jody when they were younger, when they were essentially the age they were when they made Phantasm. That's kind of neat because it's 98 and they're all a lot older now. They're all clearly, Michael in particular is an adult now.
Yes, and they use all this footage just weirdly, like just as like a kind of revise history almost in a way, or I don't know if it's supposed to be like, hey, maybe you dreamed part of this and this is like how it really went down. I don't know because some of that stuff that changed things kind of dramatically to me.
Yeah, why don't you talk about what did you think about Phantasm 4?
I feel that the reason they called it Oblivion is that it makes you sleepy. I've kind of, to some extent, enjoyed all these movies as much as I rag on them, you know, kind of jokingly. But this one was a bit of a slog to get through because you did have a lot of, like, back footage that they kind of show little bits and pieces of things that you didn't see in Phantasm and are kind of alternate to what happened in the movie. But I also had, I think they made it basically just to have one big plot point, which is to reveal the origin, quote unquote, of the Tall Man. But they really don't even do that. Like, because they had this field that Mike goes out to, like Death Valley, and he sees the Tall Man, and he tries to kill himself because he's tired of living in this game the Tall Man's creating for him. And, you know, he's like afraid of the ball in his head and all this kind of stuff. And then you get some back footage, and then all of a sudden he's like falls off the tree and is not able to kill himself. And then he sees all these portals that he could go through. These again, the I guess they're forks. They're supposed to be some
he
sort
calls
of
calls them dimensional forks
or something like that. And he goes through one and he enters this like kind of old-timey universe, parallel universe.
Essentially, the Tall Man is sitting on his front porch having lemonade.
Yes, and he's like, "Hey there, stranger, would you like some lemonade? We don't get many strangers around here."
He looks like Quaker Oats or something. It's like he's like Scream is in a Quaker Oats commercial.
Yes, and then this is why I mentioned that they had an old lady sitting there on the porch, and I think this is supposed to be the old lady from the first one, where she was like...
But she's also in Phantasm IV because she's like sitting in the car at some point, isn't she?
Yes. I it's very confusing. I'm not even sure
if they're the same old lady. You made a comment. The one that is sitting next to Scrim, who is potentially to be his wife or whoever, you point out that she looks like the fat Cenobite from the Hellraiser
kind
movies.
Kind of, yeah. But anyways, as it turns out, the Tall Man originated as a mortician. His name was Jebediah Morningside. And I think in the first movie, it was Morningside Cemetery, if I'm not mistaken.
The Morningside bit was there all along. I don't remember if they said he was Jedediah Morningside until the fourth movie.
Yes. But anyway, then you find out that how it happened was that he feels that there was some way that he could... All the keys to life and death were just around him. He could not quite barely feel it. He could sense it. He seemed that maybe this has something to do with frequencies, and he could figure out ways to extend life and stop death.
It's a little bit of
like
a Lovecraftian idea.
Yeah, and they didn't really delve too much into that. They just basically said it to kind of move the plot along. But then he kind of creates his own first attempt at this, like, what do you call it? Portal?
Dimensional fork.
Dimensional fork, yes. He kind of creates his own fork to go to another dimension. And he does, and he comes back, and now he's possessed by something else. He's something entirely different.
But theoretically, before he does this, Michael comes through the fork and talks to him, and he realizes that Michael has come through the fork. And then he's gone again.
Yes.
So before Jedediah ever goes back through the fork, he's seen someone come through, perhaps giving him the impression that maybe it's not such a bad thing. But a lot of what you just summarized is not actually in the movie. While it's clear that it probably happened... We don't really get to see Jedediah Morningside building the portal or experiencing it. There's really just the one or two scenes where, for no reason I can really infer, like, Michael doesn't go back and help the Tall Man or Jedediah Morningside, like, a la Back to the Future. Like, he has one scene where he talks to him. It's not like we get this sense of this character. All we essentially know is, hey, there was a human being whose skin suit the Tall Man is now wearing.
Yeah.
Whatever the
so, like
is.
I said, they try to kind of give you an origin to him, but you don't really even see what happens to
it's
make
very
him.
Very flimsy. This movie's terrible.
Yes.
Reggie,
and it's just long stretches of boring in between bits.
They
of
want to get Reggie into the story, and he has that one great line where he says, "I was used to be an ice cream salesman. Now I'm a soldier." Or
soldier
like
is a warrior.
And there's one random scene where, for no reason I can infer, he puts back on the ice cream suit and wears it for the rest
for
of
the
movie.
For the final battle. Yes.
Yes. He gets back into his original garb. And the it's neat seeing the old scenes because they're footage we've never seen before.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting in that sense where they're able to flashback. You're like, oh, this really are the younger versions of these guys. But it's stuff that's completely irrelevant, really, to the story. I know what you're saying about how it kind of recasts some of it, but not that much. Like, we see Jody, and we see Reggie, and we see the Reggie and Michael kind of driving around in the ice cream truck and stuff like that. We do see a really cool scene where, like, Jody tries to strangle the Tall Man by driving his car and throwing a rope around his
neck
and pulling him into the tree.
That's the scene, to me, that's the most revisionist. Like, I think that one was like, that was something we got no indication ever happened.
It kind of makes it seem like the tall man is a different sort of it. Like, not different character, but it makes him a little more interesting. Because it shows a little bit of frailty on his part, which he has
none
of. It does,
and like, maybe there's an honor amongst thieves to a certain extent. With
him. Well, because what happens is Michael cuts him down.
Yeah.
And then eventually he, in this new reality or whatever, he cuts Michael down. But there's lots of weird, kind of ridiculous scenes. The movie drags.
Speaking of ridiculous... One of my favorite parts of this movie, because it is so ridiculous, is yet again Reggie trying to mack on a lady.
And he pulls her shirt up and she has two of the spheres jutting out of her chest where her...
Yes. It's like, yeah. Reggie, haven't you learned all now? Any girl that you come across is probably going to try to kill you at some point.
As well as like a henchman, a tall man, but he just doesn't care about that. There's a really dumb scene. There are a lot of bad lines, like, oh,
real
man.
Bad.
I heard about bad cops, but this is ridiculous or something like
that.
That
whole sequence
was ridiculous.
That scene
where he fights
ridiculous.
Like an evil cop and like, and it's almost like Maniac Cop, which is another bad series,
yes.
has like jumped over into the Phantasm world. But we don't learn anything about Jebediah Morningside, really. We don't learn anything about the tall man that we didn't already maybe know. And Reggie doesn't really grow. At one point, Reggie seems like the kid is gone. The kid is completely devoid
yes.
in this movie. We don't even know where he's gone.
The
All
kid with the flying razor frisbee.
Now, I heard
is gone.
That it was implied that he was eaten just like Liz was eaten at the beginning of the second movie. But Coscarelli has this weird quote where he says, I have too much respect for the character to show him getting eaten by dwarves. Not
what?
Enough respect to remove him completely like he never existed. I understand that you can't have the kid back because 4 years have gone by and the kid's friggin' adult now.
Never stopped them before in this series.
That's fair. They could have just recast a different actor. But it's just ridiculous. And then the ending of the movie is bizarre because they blow the tall man up, and then again a second tall man comes out of the gate and
mm-hmm.
tries to tear the ball out of Michael's head. Does he?
He
does.
Yes,
and he walks
he does.
Away with it.
Yeah.
But Michael's somehow still alive and is only... just now dies.
It's just a giant hole in his head.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm dying, buddy. And then Reggie says something like, hold on, Mike, and runs off into the portal with his gun.
Yes.
And presumably it's like, okay, maybe that's the last we're ever going to see. You know, he's gone. And then they do the scene to the old footage.
Now, before we go any further, can I point out that during this whole franchise, with Reggie and his four-barreled shotgun, we finally really see the failure of this weapon to be a good weapon, because it takes so long to reload that he's like instantly swarmed by a bunch of midgets at one point, little slave guys, and like he's trying to reload this thing, and before he knows it, he's like surrounded by midgets. So it's like, this is such a terrible idea. Like, it's good for like firepower, but you can't reload that in less than like 60 seconds, so you're probably gonna get killed if you actually use this thing. Like,
they have that one good scene, though, in the beginning of the third movie where he shoots it into the air and, like, five little dwarves
yes.
fall out of the tree.
Effective then. Not so much here.
The fourth movie, though, does have that scene where, like, Michael goes to Death Valley. And then here's the other thing. Michael is getting, like, psychic powers. Like, he's getting the Force.
Yes.
And nobody knows why. He can move things. And then, talk about Star Wars ripoffs. Coscarelli can say that they made the dwarves first before the original Star Wars came out. That's fine. But in 1998, 1 year before the prequels come out, which everyone thinks is going to be huge... like, they've got a scene where he goes to Death Valley and the little dwarves are running across the cliffs just like Jawas. And then what does Michael do? He force moves
a
boulder.
It was literally almost a rip.
And
rip
clobbers off. One of the midgets right in the head with the boulder.
Yes.
Which is probably my favorite scene in the movie, which is not saying much. But, like, that was ridiculous. The
mm-hmm.
whole movie was ridiculous. And then they
it
end
was.
On this note where Reggie and Michael are in the car together driving. And Michael kind of hears... him's voice saying, I'm dying. And Reggie saying, hold on, man, I'm coming for you.
Yeah.
Reggie says, did you hear that? And then we get that weird... And the tall man says to Reggie at one point, which says several things to Reggie, but he says towards the end, it's all in his head. Which
mm-hmm.
we're not supposed to think, is that we're talking about the ball? Or there are lots of elements that go back, harken back to that idea in the first movie that this is all in his head. And that the entire series has maybe been in Michael's head all along.
I feel that Don Coscarelli worked really hard to make this a series where you really can't legitimately say definitively, one way or another, this is what's happening. Like, I think he really left it a lot of this to, this franchise is really what you make of it. To
Gosh,
each and every person.
That's fine, but the laziness really starts to show in some of the later
chapters. I feel
chapters.
Like he took a lot of work to do that. Like,
I mean, laziness in terms of storytelling. Like,
yeah,
maybe
yeah,
a lot of work, but like,
yeah.
you, at some point, no one sat down with this mess and said, what are we trying to do here? What story are we really trying to tell?
I think that's where they started with Phantasm
IV. You know why Phantasm IV is so bad is the imagery is old by this point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about the imagery. A lot of the charm of the characters is gone. Mm-hmm. Reggie, who was a lot more fun in the third movie, just is like, he's here and there. You know, there's not much
cash and a paycheck.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's just not... And I don't feel like anyone makes this movie to cash paychecks, but the... It's just there's not a lot of heart in it at all. There's not a lot of we're easy able to follow what's going on. And then it comes back around and it suggests the dream thing again, with at least mercifully this time without one of those like jump out endings.
Yes.
But it just leaves it and it's like this could have probably been the ending to the series, and it's just you're kind of weary after watching it. Like there was nothing
at the end
enjoyed.
Of that movie. I was really hoping it was going to turn into, if they do another movie, which they clearly did, it's going to be Reggie jumping through dimensions, experiencing all these wild adventures, trying to track down the Tall Man or something. I thought that would have been a cool way to proceed with the next one. But speaking of which, 2016, what's that, a span of 18 years?
I did not think this movie was ever coming out. I mean, back in the, like, I think late 90s and maybe early 2000s, Roger Avery, who's a well-known screenwriter, was a much higher profile than what the Phantasm movies usually have. I believe was working on a script. There were lots of rumors. At one point, it was rumored that Coscarelli wanted to get Bruce Campbell in for the fifth movie.
Oh, that would be...
It'd be something.
Something.
And there were a lot of different things they wanted to do, and some of them were going to be big, and Avery had this big script with lots of hellish dimensions and things going on in it, as far as I'm aware of. And it was going to be a bigger thing, but it just eventually fell off the map and didn't happen. Coscarelli went on to direct Bubba Ho-Tep,
which was pretty entertaining. I like that movie.
I mean, let's face it, probably of the movies that Coscarelli has made, that's probably the best.
I'd say that's fair.
Probably the most, you know, overall entertaining. And I think it gave him a potential. He did an episode of Masters of Horror, I think an incident on Mountain Road or something like that. Mm. And which was kind of fun, but I don't think he's done much else. And so now Coscarelli's not directing. Oh, he also did John Dies at the End, in between this, which was a weird little movie
weird
I kind of liked.
Yeah.
But this movie, not directed by Coscarelli, though he did write the screenplay.
David Hartman, co-written and co-directed.
Yeah, and Hartman pretty much has a history and a career in animation. You know, like
which
TV
is weird.
Animation. Yeah. Well, you kind of shows. Here's the thing about this movie. We watched this. We had not seen this one, obviously. We'd gone through all four. My spirits were mostly broken at that point.
I said, Nathan, I'll pony up the cash for renting this
and
one.
And that was tremendous effort. This movie's a friggin' mess.
It is.
It's
really
better
is.
Than the fourth movie. It's
yes.
Maybe better than the second movie. It's a weird deal because you said something, and then... My wife came down and joined us a little bit in the middle of the movie, and she confirmed what you said. It feels like a fan film made of Phantasm.
It really
is. It's a labor of love for people. Reggie's back. The Tall Man's back. Scrim had just died past January, but he was in the film looking incredibly old. I mean, they had to make him look like a corpse in the first few movies, but now he kind of looks like a corpse.
Yeah.
And that's a weird kind of... It's almost... You can see that they're trying hard to make him not look that bad, except
mm-hmm.
for one scene where he's in the hospital bed. And yet, it's almost it's kind of like almost just legitimately sad. Like,
it
I don't
is.
Mean sad that he's there, but like you're like, oh, I can see he was kind of really dying. Like,
mm-hmm.
the thing with the Phantasm series, it does not stand up once reality is invoked at all. So like,
yeah.
when you have the guy who looks like he's on death's door for real, it just takes you out of the movie a little bit. The movie's ridiculous because it seems to, it's all over the map. Reggie is literally the focal point character.
Mm-hmm.
And they play with that, is it a dream stuff, so badly that at one point in the movie, every character is trying to convince the others that it's in their head. Like, Reggie is telling Michael it's in his head. Michael is telling Reggie it's in his head. At one point, the Tall Man says,
yes.
maybe it's in my head. He's not even sure who's
yes.
dreaming it. He implies, he's like, I don't know, guys. It's hard to even set this up. Reggie's running through different worlds fighting the Tall Man. But at the same time, it's jumping back and forth, kind of almost like Chris Marker's... Le Jeté, which was turned into 12 Monkeys by Terry Gilliam, he's in a retirement home, a mental, not a mental hospital, he's in a hospital, though.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's legitimately in possibly like an old age home or just a
yeah.
hospital where he's dying. But he's in two different hospitals. At one point, he's in a modern-day hospital where Jody has died. Michael is there coming and visiting him and taking care of him. And that basically, and this is where the mental hospital part comes in, is that he has dementia. That Reggie has dementia. Mm-hmm. And his dementia has manifested itself as the tall man. So now we're getting the idea that it was never Michael's dream, but it was all Reggie's in his head, maybe. But then Reggie wakes up sometimes and he's in an old, like, Civil War era hospital, and Jedediah Morningside is in the bed next to him. And he's convinced at that point that he's the one dreaming all of this.
Yeah.
So both...
It really is bizarre.
We don't know why that part happens, but Reggie's having all these visions. And then at some point he fights the balls and everything. The special effects are horrible in this movie.
They have gone so downhill, it was ridiculous. I understand that they probably didn't have a lot of money.
They're like Sci-Fi Channel quality.
It was worse than Sci-Fi, even almost than Sci-Fi Channel quality. Like, this looks worse than something the Asylum made.
It's about on that level. There is a one scene where, like, the balls, like, decimate a horse.
Yes, but it was like every spot of blood in this movie is complete CGI blood.
It's a shame. It's like
super
for how little it was made, the budget it was made the first time through. It's almost disappointing that they do this one to the level that they, you know, that it was made this badly, because I feel like they could have taken their resources and made a smaller, more modest movie. And I don't think anyone would have balked at it. Had we done some cheaper practical effects and everything, nobody would have said, where's the CGI? It wasn't necessary.
No, yeah, exactly.
Daniel Roebuck shows up as a really weird character, like the Danish gardener or something.
Something,
like,
yes.
Hans or something, and he's like, that scene's ridiculous where he and Reggie are trying to fight the balls. And then happens?
In case you're wondering to yourself, this is the fifth Phantasm film. Does Reggie find a girl to say, you know, it's really, the road is really hard on a man? Well, yes, he does. He has a girl named Dawn, and he's into, and he's like, tries to mack on
her. He doesn't get her either.
And he also is like, well, I'm going to stay up all night and write a song about you.
That part I kind of like, because it was so ridiculous. Like, it kind of harkened back to the Reggie of the first Phantasm
movie. It did,
movies.
It did.
And he's an old dude sitting there right in the middle of the battle with the Phantasms. In the tall man, he stays up, and he's trying to find Michael. He stays up all night to write a song for this chick, presumably just to, like, hook up with her, which doesn't happen.
Of course not. This.
But then the movie goes on.
Maybe his dementia is onset because he's so lonely or something.
And
the
other thing we mentioned, they keep talking about all these series have the cars, right? Like, you know, the Evil Dead has the Oldsmobile, the Delta that he drives around
the
in.
The Hemi
Cuda. The Phantasm has a Hemi Cuda, and they keep talking about it. And he has to keep referring to it as a Hemi Cuda, like, all through the movie. And I think one of the best transitions in the movie is when you see the wheel of the Hemi Cuda rolling, and it turns into Reggie's wheelchair as he's wheeling, as he's being wheeled through the hospital. But they don't really do a lot with that. It just keeps popping back and forth.
It really is just, like, popping back and forth in time and place and dimension and all this kind of stuff.
And it almost becomes like a weirdo It's a Wonderful Life in reverse,
certain elements
or something,
of it, yeah.
Where he goes into a world that's now completely ruled by the tall man.
Yes.
And
the
giant
tall man
balls
has summoned giant spheres to destroy skyscrapers.
That are flying around starships in War of the Worlds.
Yes,
you
and
know,
he's like
the
released some kind of alien virus to decimate the world's populations.
Yeah, and so then basically Reggie joins up with the resistance force led by Michael.
And a midget named Chunk.
Yes.
Who is not a dead person. Who's not a dead smashed down dwarf for the tall man.
But you and I were saying, look, if there isn't a scene where he gets into a one-on-one fight with the dwarves, that's going to be a completely wasted opportunity. It's even better because he disguises himself as one of the dwarves, again, Wizard of Oz, and infiltrates their ranks and starts just fighting them. And I think is responsible for killing the tall man, or one iteration of the tall man. We're not really sure what's going on. And then they fight the tall man. They seemingly win for now. They go back on the road. The tall man reveals something in this movie, which is that there are varying versions of him all across time and space.
Mm-hmm.
And that you'll never be able to
get
rid of him.
And Michael tried to tell that to Reggie, too, at one point. Like, he was like, well, you know, there's different... that some people believe that the universe is laid out on top of each other, all these multiverses like laid out on top of each other going on at the same time, and things in them might be slightly different, but they are like slightly different versions of what's going on now, and you can just kind of feel the membranes of these universes like on top of each other. It's like a weird discussion he has with them.
They really overexplain things in this movie. They try to, but it, since it doesn't make sense already,
yeah,
it just feels like a wet blanket on top of a wet blanket. Like, it's sort of like you're not telling us anything new. You're not giving us new information. The movie is just kind of, it becomes less interesting the more you try to explain it away. And again, the movie doesn't make much sense. Because once they've done this, and we're just a little late in the game, I think, to address spoiler alerts, but the end of this movie, and I'm just going to talk about it, because the thing is, what does this movie all amount to? It seems to amount to the fact that Reggie is basically hallucinating all of this in some dementia-fueled daydream. But that doesn't actually explain everything. So the movie has a scene, a weird scene, where... So Jody shows back up. They're driving the Hemi Cuda.
Super pudgy Jody.
Super pudgy Jody. He looks fat and happy. No one else does. He swings up. He picks up Reggie. Picks up Michael. They're driving off to fight the tall man once more as brothers and friends.
And the souped up Hemi Cuda with, like, machine guns
So now the Hemi Cuda's all outfitted like Mad Max. We're back to that apocalypse world. We're driving down the highway. Seemingly, Michael and Jody and Reggie are all that are left of the resistance, but they're headed forward, fight the tall man. They're all united. And then Reggie starts to, like, pass out in the back seat of the Hemi Cuda. And when he passes out, he wakes up back in the hospital. And I don't know if this is bad editing. He's not in the hospital scene originally, because in that world, Michael is talking to him about how Jody has died. When he wakes up, and then he has dementia. When he wakes up the last time, he's literally dying. In that moment, and Jody and Michael, who address each other and are seemingly both aware of each other, are there by his bedside.
Yes, it's ridiculous.
So he's dying in a world where Jody is alive, and Michael is alive, and he's still in the hospital. It's implied, at least for about 30 seconds, when the credits initially roll, this kind of poignant ending where Reggie's dying, and this whole thing has been part of his life, and this is the end, and they're back together as friends. It's supposed to be a nice, warm little coda, and I liked it. It was fine. But he essentially drives off, like, Brazil style, into the sunset while dying in the real world. And then we get...
the after-credit scene.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that, because my head's starting to hurt.
It is bizarre, because they have what could be considered a nice little wrap-up series, and then they move on to, well, do you remember Rocky from Phantasm 3?
Who, maybe you do.
Well, she pops back up again in, like, the apocalyptic wasteland universe or multiverse, where
Flaming Chunk comes through the portal.
As a Flaming Chunk flies
through the portal. And he's still kind of partly together. Like, his arm is blown off.
Yes, and he's like, and he starts... This is the greatest thing ever, because he starts macking on Rocky. He's like, Rocky, hey, just seems to know I'm him. I'm the only guy in the world. Like, what do you think? You think we could get together? She's like, well, maybe I could get used to the idea.
But then the Cuda rolls
then
up.
Then the Cuda rolls
they
up.
Get up.
And
Reggie's there, and they all start talking to each
and
other.
And Reggie's not, like, passing out anymore. He's, like, fully part of the thing.
They're all like, in it. They're like, yeah, man, let's go. And, like, off they go to battle the tall man who seemingly is back. And
they show, like, little clips and stuff as the credits continue,
like,
to
animated
roll.
Clips,
like animated clips of them, like, having little skirmishes against giant spheres in the sky and, like, armies and stuff. So you get the idea that in this universe, like, they're continuing a fight or something. It's just really confusing.
So the only theory I have with this, then, so basically it undercuts this idea that this is all Reggie's fantasy world after he dies. That makes no sense.
Yeah, it does.
So the only thing I can assume is that this is similar to Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-5, where Billy Pilgrim becomes unstuck in time and therefore can move freely about in worlds, various places. And at one minute he's on Tralafagor, which is another planet, and then at one moment he's like in a war. And yet, in Phantasm, Reggie seems to be unstuck in time and space, and moving between all the multiverses. His consciousness seems to be popping in and out of the multiverses.
Yes.
So there's a weird idea that maybe Reggie, when he jumps through the portal at the end of Phantasm 4, he essentially is unstuck like the tall man, who can seemingly access himself at any point in time or space across the universes. And Reggie, though, doesn't have that ability. I'm just completely making things up because that's what everyone else has done.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that Reggie is somehow moving in and out of these universes, but that his psyche in some form is kind of fractured. And perhaps when one of these iterations dies, it allows his mind to be more put together, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So he's focused in. So at the end, it seems like when he dies in this other universe, whichever one that is, he seems to be focused in and in the here and now in this other world. Unless it is just a death fantasy where all his buddies are together.
Who knows?
But there's nothing to support either one, really.
Yeah.
The one makes more sense because it seems like the storyline is still going.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they've introduced so many weird ideas. But I just ran out of steam. I think I said I could see how this would be a satisfying or satisfactory is probably a better way to say graphic novel. I could see how they could have taken the events of this movie and made them into a decent graphic novel. But everyone's old. A lot of them seem out of practice as actors. I'm glad that Scrim was in the movie, that he got to finish it.
Yeah.
But those scenes aren't very good. He just seems old and tired.
Yeah.
Reggie seems really old and tired.
Yeah.
He seems older than Angus and some, and just he seems.
And Michael, it looks like he almost seems like, I can't believe I'm still doing these.
He's like turned into old Bob Saget.
Yeah, kind of.
There's
some similarities there.
So
my final takeaway of this movie, this particular movie, I'm not talking about the franchise, but this movie, is that as much as I sound like I'm ragging on it, I kind of am, but at the same time, I will give them credit for like creating, getting funding, and finishing this kind of just the way they wanted to do it.
If you're a fan of the Phantasm series, if you really are a fan, if you know you like it, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be frustrated by some things, but you'll be glad you saw it.
Yeah, absolutely. But at the end of the day, it's not really.
I don't think it doesn't diminish the fact that there was really only one interesting movie here to begin with.
Yes.
And that there was no need for this thing to be a series. In the ranking, the first one's the best. Mm-hmm. I'd say the third one, just by sheer fact that it's coherent and mostly enjoyable, is my second favorite. I'd probably then honestly go to Ravager, just because even it's ridiculous and not that well made. There were things that made me think, at least a little bit. Like, there were some interesting ideas there. Mm-hmm. Two is just a potpourri of, like, random images. Yeah, potpourri of random images. And the fourth movie is just
forgettable,
a dull, padded out mess.
Yeah, I would agree with that for the most part. I think my favorite, of course, Phantasm. I would go to Phantasm 3 as my number 2. I actually kind of liked Phantasm 2 more than Ravager as my third because of the fact that it's just so bizarre. It was like,
yeah,
I give points for something to be kind of bizarre.
You could ask me in 5 minutes, and the position of those two could probably change.
Fair enough. And then I would end it out with probably Ravager and then Oblivion. So,
not a great series.
Not a great series, but it does have some highlights, and there are some interesting
things. Haven't seen them, I'd say check out the first one. If you're a huge fan, you've seen all but the fifth one.
You'll still want to check out the fifth one.
Yeah, even though we've gone over every plot point, you probably still don't know what actually happens in the movie. And that's okay.
I sure know I don't, and I've seen it. So,
so that's it.
Yeah.
That is Phantasm.
I wish they would just sort of rename the series Reggie Trying to Get with Ladies and his troubles.
Well, I think if Starz wants to pick up a TV series, Reggie's a little more long in the tooth even than Bruce Campbell as Ash Williams. So
yeah. Reggie versus the Tall Man.
Yes. Well, they need a new Tall Man at this point. I think the thing is, there was a lot of interesting ideas in this series. And I am in no way or
really
shape or form a proponent of remakes.
Yeah.
And in a sense, every one of these movies was a remake of the one that came before it.
In a certain way.
But I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to someone taking another stab at this material. But honestly, just go out there and make some new movies with new images. That's what was fascinating about the first movie.
Yeah.
That they wanted to make something with some new images and some new ideas. So, well, that's all we have. That is fantastic. You can find all of them online.
On demand.
Yeah, on Amazon, I think, has almost all of them available now. And Phantasm Ravager is there as well. I know that 1 through 4 are on DVD. I think Ravager's coming out soon, maybe in December. You'll be able to get it, but you can get it on demand right now on VOD, which is how we saw it.
Yep.
For $6.99, which get a bunch of people together and make everyone pay a dollar. So until next time, guys, take care.
All right. See you guys.